Philip felt guilty about letting him down. I'll explain myself to him afterward, he thought, unless he's too angry. Remigius was about to press on with the indictment when another voice said, I would like to confess. Everyone looked. It was William Bovis, the original offender, standing up and looking shamefaced. I was flicking pellets of mud at the novice master and laughing, he said in a low, clear voice. Brother Philip made me ashamed. I beg God's forgiveness and ask the brothers to give me a penance. He sat down abruptly. Before Remigius could react, another youngster stood up and said, I have a confession. I did the same. I ask for a penance. He sat down again. This sudden access of guilty conscience was infectious. A third monk confessed, then a fourth, then a fifth. The truth was out, despite Philip's scruples, and he could not help feeling pleased. He saw that Milius was struggling to suppress a triumphant smile. The confession left no doubt that there had been a minor riot going on under the noses of the sacrist and the circuiter. The culprits were sentenced by a highly displeased Remigius to a week of total silence. They were not to speak, and no one was to speak to them. It was a harsher punishment than it sounded. Philip had suffered it when he was young. Even for one day the isolation was oppressive, and a whole week of it was utterly miserable. But Remigius was merely giving vent to his anger at having been outmaneuvered. Once they had confessed, he had no option but to punish them, although in punishing them he was conceding that Philip had been right in the first place. His attack on Philip had gone badly wrong, and Philip was triumphant. Despite a guilty pang, he relished the moment. But Remigius's humiliation was not yet complete. Cuthbert spoke again. There was another disturbance that we ought to discuss. It took place in the cloisters just after High Mass. Philip wondered what on earth was coming next. Brother Andrew confronted Brother Philip and accused him of misconduct. Of course he did, Philip was thinking. Everyone knows that. Cuthbert went on. Now we all know that the time and place for such accusations is here and now in chapter, and there are good reasons why our forebears ordained it so. Tempers cool overnight, and grievances can be discussed the next morning in an atmosphere of calm and moderation, and the whole community can bring its collective wisdom to bear on the problem. But I regret to say, Andrew flouted this sensible rule and made a scene in the cloisters, disturbing everyone and speaking intemperately. To let such misbehavior pass would be unfair on the younger brothers who have been punished for what they have done. It was merciless and it was brilliant, Philip thought happily. The question of whether Philip had been right to take William out of the choir during the service had never actually been discussed. Every attempt to raise it had been turned into an inquiry into the behavior of the accuser. And that was as it should be, for Andrew's complaint against Philip had been insincere. Between them, Cuthbert and Milius had now discredited Remigius and his two main allies, Andrew and Pierre. Andrew's normally red face was purple with fury, and Remigius looked almost frightened. Philip was pleased. They deserved it. But now he worried that their humiliation was in danger of going too far. "It's unseemly for junior brothers to discuss the punishment of their seniors," he said. "Let's the sub-prior deal with this matter privately." Looking around, he saw that the monks approved of his magnanimity, and he realized that unintentionally he had scored yet another point. It seemed to be all over. The mood of the meeting was with Philip, and he felt sure he had won over most of the waverers. Then Remigius said, "There is another matter I have to raise." Philip studied the sub-prior's face. He looked desperate. Philip glanced at Andrew Sacrist and Pierre Circuiter, and saw that they both looked surprised. This was something unplanned, then. Was Remigius going to plead for the job, perhaps? "Most of you know that the bishop has a right to nominate candidates for our consideration," Remigius began. "He may also refuse to confirm our choice. This division of powers can lead to quarrelling between bishop and monastery, as some older brothers know from experience. In the end, the bishop cannot force us to accept his candidate, nor can we insist on ours. And where there is conflict, it has to be resolved by negotiation. In that case, the outcome depends a good deal on the determination and unity of the brothers, especially their unity." Philip had a bad feeling about this. Remigius had suppressed his rage and was once again calm and haughty. Philip still did not know what was coming, but his triumphant feeling evaporated. "The reason I mention all this today is that two important items of information have come to my notice," Remigius went on. "The first is that there may be more than one candidate nominated from among us here in this room." That didn't surprise anyone, Philip thought. "The second is that the bishop will also nominate a candidate." There was a pregnant pause. This was bad news for both parties. Someone said, "Do you know whom the bishop wants?" "Yes," Remigius said, and in that instant Philip felt sure the man was lying. "The bishop's choice is Brother Osbert of Newbury." One or two of the monks gasped. They were all horrified. They knew Osbert, for he had been circuitor at Kingsbridge for a while. He was the bishop's illegitimate son, and he regarded the church purely as a means whereby he could live a life of idleness and plenty. He had never made any serious attempt to abide by his vows, but kept up a semi-transparent sham and relied upon his paternity to keep him out of trouble. The prospect of having him as prior was appalling, even to Remigius's friends. Only the guest-master and one or two of his irredeemably depraved cronies might favour Osbert, in anticipation of a regime of slack discipline and slovenly indulgence. Remigius ploughed on. "If we nominate two candidates, brothers, the bishop may say that we are divided and cannot make up our collective mind, so therefore he must decide for us, and we should accept his choice. If we want to resist Osbert, we would do well to put forward one candidate only. And perhaps I should add, we should make sure that our candidate cannot easily be faulted, for example, on grounds of youth or inexperience." There was a murmur of assent. Philip was devastated. A moment ago he had been sure of victory, but it had been snatched from his grasp. Now all the monks were with Remigius, seeing him as the safe candidate, the unity candidate, the man to beat Osbert. Philip felt sure Remigius was lying about Osbert, but it would make no difference. The monks were scared now, and they would back Remigius, and that meant more years of decline for Kingsbridge Priory. Before anyone could comment, Remigius said, "Let us now dismiss, and think and pray about this problem, as we do God's work today." He stood up and went out, followed by Andrew, Pierre, and John Small, these three looking dazed but triumphant. As soon as they had gone, a buzz of conversation broke out among the others. Milius said to Philip, "I never thought Remigius had it in him to pull a trick like that." "He's lying," Philip said bitterly. "I'm sure of it." Cuthbert joined them and heard Philip's remark. "It doesn't really matter if he's lying, does it?" he said. "The threat is enough." "The truth will come out eventually," Philip said. "Not necessarily," Milius replied. "Suppose the bishop doesn't nominate Osbert. Remigius will just say the bishop yielded before the prospect of a battle with a united priory." "I'm not ready to give in," Philip said stubbornly. Milius said, "What else will we do?" "We must find out the truth," Philip said. "We can't," said Milius. Philip racked his brains. The frustration was agony. "Why can't we just ask?" he said. "Ask? What do you mean?" "Ask the bishop what his intentions are." "How?" "We could send a message to the bishop's palace, couldn't we?" Philip said, thinking aloud. He looked at Cuthbert. Cuthbert was thoughtful. "Yes, I send messengers out all the time. I can send one to the palace." Milius said skeptically, "And ask the bishop what his intentions are." Philip frowned. That was the problem. Cuthbert agreed with Milius. "The bishop won't tell us," he said. Philip was struck by an inspiration. His brow cleared, and he punched his palm excitedly as he saw the solution. "No," he said, "the bishop won't tell us, but his archdeacon will." That night Philip dreamed about Jonathan, the abandoned baby. In his dream, the child was in the porch of the chapel at St. John in the Forest, and Philip was inside, reading the service of prime, when a wolf came slinking out of the woods and crossed the field, smooth as a snake, heading for the baby. Philip was afraid to move, for fear of causing a disturbance during the service, and being reprimanded by Remigius and Andrew, both of whom were there, although in reality neither of them had ever been to the cell. He decided to shout, But although he tried, no sound would come, as often happened in dreams. At last he made such an effort to call out that he woke himself up, and lay in the dark, trembling, while he listened to the breathing of the sleeping monks all around him, and slowly convinced himself that the wolf was not real. He had hardly thought of the baby since arriving at Kingsbridge. He wondered what he would do with the child if he were to become prior. Everything would be different then. A baby in a little monastery hidden in the forest was of no consequence, however unusual. The same baby at Kingsbridge Priory would cause a stir. On the other hand, what was wrong with that? It was not a sin to give people something to talk about. He would be prior, so he could do as he pleased. He could bring Johnny Eightpence to Kingsbridge to take care of the baby. The idea pleased him inordinately. "That's just what I'll do," he thought. Then he remembered that in all probability he would not become prior. He lay awake until dawn in a fever of impatience. There was nothing he could do now to press his case. It was useless to talk to the monks, for their thinking was dominated by the threat of Osbert. A few of them had even approached Philip and told him they were sorry he had lost, as if the election had already been held. He had resisted the temptation to call them faithless cowards. He just smiled and told them they might yet be surprised. But his own faith was not strong. Archdeacon Walleran might not be at the bishop's palace, or he might be there, but have some reason for not wanting to tell Philip the bishop's plans. Or, most likely of all, given the archdeacon's character, he might have plans of his own. Philip got up at dawn with the other monks and went into the church for prime, the first service of the day. Afterward he headed for the refectory, intending to take his breakfast with the others. But Milius intercepted him and beckoned him, with a furtive gesture, to the kitchen. Philip followed him, his nerves wound taut. The messenger must be back. That was quick. He must have got his reply immediately and started back yesterday afternoon. Even so, he had been fast. Philip did not know a horse in the priory stable that was capable of doing the journey so rapidly. But what would the answer be? It was not the messenger who was waiting in the kitchen. It was the archdeacon himself, Walleran Bygod. Philip stared at him in surprise. The thin black-draped form of the archdeacon was perched on a stool like a crow on a tree stump. The end of his beaky nose was red with cold. He was warming his bony white hands around a cup of hot spiced wine. "It's good of you to come," Philip blurted out.
"I'm glad you wrote to me,"
Walleran said coolly.
"Is it true?" Philip asked impatiently. "Will the bishop nominate Osbert?"
Walleran held up a hand to stop him.
"I'll get to that. Cuthbert here is just telling me of yesterday's events."
Philip concealed his disappointment. This was not a straightforward answer. He studied Walleran's face, trying to read his mind. Walleran did indeed have plans of his own, but Philip could not guess what they were. Cuthbert, whom Philip had not at first noticed, sitting by the fire, dipping his horse bread into his beer to soften it for his elderly teeth, resumed an account of yesterday's chapter. Philip fidgeted restlessly, trying to guess what Walleran might be up to. He tried a morsel of bread, but found he was too tense to swallow. He drank some of the watery beer, just to have something to do with his hands.
"And so," Cuthbert said at last, "it seemed that our only chance was to try to verify the bishop's intentions, and fortunately Philip felt able to presume upon his acquaintanceship with yourself. So we sent you the message."
Philip said impatiently, "And now will you tell us what we want to know?"
"Yes, I'll tell you."
Walleran put down his wine, untasted. "The bishop would like his son to be prior of Kingsbridge." Philip's heart sank.
"So Remigius told the truth?"
Walleran went on. "However, the bishop is not willing to risk a quarrel with the monks." Philip frowned. This was more or less what Remigius had forecast, but something was not quite right. Philip said to Walleran, "You didn't come all this way just to tell us that." Walleran shot a look of respect at Philip, and Philip knew he had guessed right.
"No," Walleran said, "the bishop has asked me to test the mood of the monastery, and he has empowered me to make a nomination on his behalf. Indeed, I have with me the bishop's seal, so that I can write a letter of nomination to make the matter formal and binding. I have his full authority, you see.
Philip took a moment to digest that. Walleran was empowered to make a nomination and seal it with the bishop's seal. That meant the bishop had put the whole matter in Walleran's hands. He now spoke with the bishop's authority. Philip took a deep breath and said, "Do you accept what Cuthbert has told you? That if Osbert were to be nominated, it would cause the quarrel the bishop wants to avoid?"
"Yes, I understand that," said Walleran.
"Then you won't nominate Osbert?"
"No."
Philip felt wound up tight enough to snap. The monks would be so glad to escape the threat of Osbert that they would gratefully vote for whoever Walleran might nominate. Walleran now had the power to choose the new prior. Philip said,
"Then whom will you nominate?"
Walleran said,
"You, or Remigius."
"Remigius's ability to run the priory—"
"I know his abilities, and yours," Walleran interrupted, once again holding up a thin white hand to stop Philip.
"I know which of you would make the best prior."
He paused. "But there is another matter."
"What now?" wondered Philip.
What else was there to consider, other than who would make the best prior? He looked at the others. Milius was also mystified, but old Cuthbert had a slight smile, as if he knew what was coming.
Walleran said, "Like you, I'm anxious that important posts in the church should go to energetic and capable men, regardless of age, rather than being handed out as rewards for long service to senior men, whose holiness may be greater than their administrative ability."
"Of course," Philip said impatiently. He did not see the relevance of this lecture.
"We should work together to this end, you three and me."
Milius said, "I don't know what you're getting at."
"I do," said Cuthbert.
Walleran gave Cuthbert a thin smile, then returned his attention to Philip.
"Let me be plain," he said. "The bishop himself is old. One day he will die, and then we will need a new bishop, just as today we need a new prior. The monks of Kingsbridge have the right to elect the new bishop, for the bishop of Kingsbridge is also the abbot of the priory."
Philip frowned. All this was irrelevant. They were electing a prior, not a bishop. But Walleran went on. "Of course the monks will not be completely free to choose whom they like to be bishop, for the archbishop and the king will have their views. But in the end it is the monks who legitimize the appointment, and when that time comes, you three will have a powerful influence on the decision." Cuthbert was nodding as if his guess had turned out to be right, and now Philip too had an inkling of what was coming. Walleran finished. "You want me to make you prior of Kingsbridge. I want you to make me bishop." So that was it. Philip stared in silence at Walleran. It was very simple. The archdeacon wanted to make a deal. Philip was shocked. It was not quite the same as buying and selling a clerical office, which was known as the sin of simony, but it had an unpleasantly commercial feeling about it. He tried to think objectively about the proposal. It would mean that Philip would become prior. His heart beat faster at the thought. He was reluctant to quibble with anything that would give him the priory. It would mean that Walleran would probably become bishop at some point. Would he be a good bishop? He would certainly be competent. He appeared to have no serious vices. He had a rather worldly, practical approach to the service of God, but then so did Philip. Philip sensed that Walleran had a ruthless edge that he himself lacked, but he also sensed that it was based on a genuine determination to protect and nurture the interests of the church. Who else might be a candidate when the bishop eventually died? Probably Osbert. It was not unknown for religious offices to be passed from father to son, despite the official requirement of clerical celibacy. Osbert, of course, would be even more of a liability to the church as bishop than he would be as prior. It would be worth supporting a much worse candidate than Walleran just to keep Osbert out. Would anyone else be in the running? It was impossible to guess. It might be years yet before the bishop died. Cuthbert said to Walleran, "We couldn't guarantee to get you elected,
I know, said Walleran. I'm asking only for your nomination. Appropriately, that's exactly what I have to offer you in return. A nomination.
Cuthbert nodded. I'll agree to that, he said solemnly.
So will I, said Milius.
The archdeacon and the two monks looked at Philip. He hesitated, torn. This was not the way to choose a bishop, he knew. But the priory was within his grasp. It could not be right to barter one holy office for another like horse traders, but if he refused, the result might be that Remigius became prior and Osbert became bishop. However, the rational arguments now seemed academic. The desire to be prior was like an irresistible force within him, and he could not refuse, regardless of the pros and cons. He recalled the prayer he had sent up yesterday, telling God that he intended to fight for the job. He raised his eyes now and sent up another. If you don't want this to happen, then still my tongue and paralyze my mouth, and stop my breath in my throat, and prevent me from speaking. Then he looked at Walleran and said, I accept. The prior's bed was huge, 3 times the width of any bed Philip had ever slept in. The wooden base stood half the height of a man, and there was a feather mattress on top of that. It had curtains all around to keep out drafts, and on the curtains, biblical scenes had been embroidered by the patient hands of a pious woman. Philip examined it with some misgivings. It seemed to him enough of an extravagance that the prior should have a bedroom all to himself. Philip had never in his life had his own bedroom, and tonight would be the first time he had ever slept alone. The bed was too much. He considered having a straw mattress brought over from the dormitory, and moving the bed into the infirmary, where it would ease an ailing monk's old bones. But of course the bed was not just for Philip. When the priory had an especially distinguished guest, a bishop or a great lord or even a king, then the guest would have this bedroom and the prior would shift as best he could somewhere else. So Philip could not really get rid of it.
You'll sleep soundly tonight, said Walleran by God, not without a hint of envy.
I suppose I shall, Philip said dubiously. Everything had happened very quickly. Walleran had written a letter to the priory right there in the kitchen, ordering the monks to hold an immediate election and nominating Philip. He had signed the letter with the bishop's name and sealed it with the bishop's seal. Then the four of them had gone into chapter. As soon as Remigius saw them enter, he knew the battle was over. Walleran read the letter, and the monks cheered when he got to Philip's name. Remigius had the wit to dispense with the formality of the vote and concede defeat. And Philip was prior. He had conducted the rest of chapter in something of a daze, and then had walked across the lawns to the prior's house, in the southeast corner of the priory close, to take up residence. When he saw the bed, he realized that his life had changed utterly and irrevocably. He was different, special, set apart from other monks. He had power and privilege, and he had responsibility. He alone had to make sure that this little community of 45 men survived and prospered. If they starved, it would be his fault. If they became depraved, he would be to blame. If they disgraced God's church, God would hold Philip responsible. He had sought this burden, he reminded himself. Now he must bear it. His first duty as prior would be to lead the monks into church for High Mass. Today was Epiphany, the 12th day of Christmas and a holiday. All the villagers would be at the service, and more people would come from the surrounding district. A good cathedral with a strong body of monks and a reputation for spectacular services could attract 1,000 people or more. Even dreary Kingsbridge would draw most of the local gentry, for the service was a social occasion too, when they could meet their neighbours and talk business. But before the service, Philip had something else to discuss with Walleran, now that they were alone at last.
That information I passed you, he began, about the Earl of Shiring.
Walleran nodded. I haven't forgotten. Indeed, that could be more important than the question of who is prior or bishop. Earl Bartholomew has arrived in England already. They expect him at Shiring tomorrow.
What are you going to do? Philip said anxiously.
I'm going to make use of Sir Percy Hamley.
In fact, I'm hoping he'll be in the congregation today.
I've heard of him, but I've never seen him,
Philip said.
Look for a fat lord with a hideous wife and a handsome son. You can't miss the wife. She's an eyesore.
What makes you think they will take King Stephen's side against Earl Bartholomew?
They hate the Earl passionately.
Why?
The son, William, was engaged to marry the Earl's daughter, but she took against him and the marriage was called off, much to the humiliation of the Hamleys. They're still smarting from the insult, and they'll jump at any chance to strike back at Bartholomew.
Philip nodded, satisfied. He was glad to have shed that responsibility. He had a full quota. Kingsbridge Priory was a big enough problem for him to manage. Walleran could take care of the world outside.
They left the prior's house and walked back to the cloisters. The monks were waiting. Philip took his place at the head of the line, and the procession moved off. It was a good moment when he walked into the church with the monks singing behind him. He liked it more than he had anticipated. He told himself that his new eminence symbolized the power he now had to do good, and that was why he was so profoundly thrilled. He wished Abbot Peter from Gwynedd could see him. The old man would be so proud. He led the monks into the choir stalls. A major service such as this one was often taken by the bishop. Today it would be led by the bishop's deputy, Archdeacon Walleran. As Walleran began, Philip scanned the congregation, looking for the family Walleran had described. There were about 150 people standing in the nave, the wealthy in their heavy winter cloaks and leather shoes, the peasants in their rough jackets and felt boots or wooden clogs. Philip had no trouble picking out the Hamleys. They were near the front, close to the altar. He saw the woman first. Walleran had not exaggerated. She was repulsive. She wore a hood, but most of her face was visible, and he could see that her skin was covered with unsightly boils, which she touched nervously all the time. Beside her was a heavy man of about 40 years. That would be Percy. His clothes showed him to be a man of considerable wealth and power, but not in the top rank of barons and earls. The sun was leaning against one of the massive columns of the nave. He was a fine figure of a man, with very yellow hair and narrow, haughty eyes. A marriage with an earl's family would have enabled the Hamleys to cross the line that divided county gentry from the nobility of the kingdom. It was no wonder they were angry about the cancellation of the wedding. Philip returned his mind to the service. Walleran was going through it a little too fast for Philip's taste. He wondered again whether he had been right to agree to nominate Walleran as bishop when the present bishop should die. Walleran was a dedicated man, but he appeared to undervalue the importance of worship. The prosperity and power of the church were only means to an end, after all. The ultimate object was the salvation of souls. Philip decided that he must not worry about Walleran too much. The thing was done now, and anyway, the bishop would probably frustrate Walleran's ambition by living another 20 years. The congregation was noisy. None of them knew the responses, of course. Only priests and monks were expected to take part, except in the most familiar prayers and the amens. Some of the congregation watched in reverent silence, but others wandered around, greeting one another and chatting. They're simple people, Philip thought. You have to do something to keep their attention. The service drew to a close, and Archdeacon Walleran addressed them. Most of you know that the beloved prior of Kingsbridge has died. His body, which lies here with us in church, will be laid to rest in the priory graveyard today after dinner. The bishop and the monks have chosen as his successor Brother Philip of Gwynedd, who led us into church this morning. He stopped and Philip stood up to lead the procession out. Then Walleran said, I have another sad announcement. Philip was taken by surprise. He sat down promptly. I have just received a message, Walleran said. He had received no messages, Philip knew. They had been together all morning. What was the sly archdeacon up to now? The message tells me of a loss which will grieve us all deeply. He paused again. Someone was dead, but who?
Walleran had known about it before he arrived, but he had kept it a secret, and he was going to pretend that he had only just heard the news. Why? Philip could think of only one possibility, and if Philip's suspicions were right, Walleran was much more ambitious and unscrupulous than Philip had imagined. Had he really deceived and manipulated them all? Had Philip been a mere pawn in Walleran's game? Walleran's final words confirmed that he had. "Dearly beloved," he said solemnly, "the Bishop of Kingsbridge is dead." Chapter 3.
"That bitch will be there," said William's mother. "I'm sure she will."
William looked at the looming facade of Kingsbridge Cathedral with mingled dread and longing. If the Lady Aliena were to be at the Epiphany service, it would be painfully embarrassing for them all. But nevertheless his heart quickened at the thought of seeing her again. They were trotting along the road to Kingsbridge, William and his father on war horses, and his mother on a fine courser, with three knights and three grooms following. They made an impressive and even fearsome party, which pleased William, and the peasants walking on the road scattered before their powerful horses, but Mother was seething.
"They all know, even these wretched serfs," she said through her teeth. "They even tell jokes about us. When is a bride not a bride? When the groom is Will Hamley. I had a man flogged for that, but it did no good. I'd like to get hold of that bitch. I'd flay her alive and hang her skin on a nail and let the birds peck her flesh."
William wished she would not go on about it. The family had been humiliated, and it had been William's fault, or so Mother said, and he did not want to be reminded of it. They clattered over the rickety wooden bridge that led to Kingsbridge village, and urged their horses up the sloping main street to the priory. There were already 20 or 30 horses cropping the sparse grass of the graveyard on the north side of the church, but none as fine as those of the Hamleys. They rode up to the stable and left their mounts with the priory grooms. They crossed the green in formation, William and his father on either side of Mother, then the knights behind them, and the grooms bringing up the rear. People stood aside for them, but William could see them nudging one another and pointing, and he felt sure they were whispering about the cancelled wedding. He risked a glance at Mother, and he could tell by the thunderous look on her face that she thought the same. They went into the church. William hated churches. They were cold and dim even in fine weather, and there was always that faintly corrupt smell lingering in the dark corners and the low tunnels of the aisles. Worst of all, churches made him think of the torments of hell, and he was frightened of hell. He raked the congregation with his eyes. At first he could hardly distinguish people's faces because of the gloom. After a few moments his eyes adjusted. He could not see Aliena. They progressed up the aisle. She did not seem to be here. He felt both relieved and let down. Then he saw her, and his heart missed a beat. She was on the south side of the nave near the front, escorted by a knight William did not know, surrounded by men-at-arms and ladies-in-waiting. She had her back to him, but her mass of dark curly hair was unmistakable. As he spotted her, she turned, showing a soft, curved cheek and a straight, imperious nose. Her eyes, so dark they were almost black, met William's. He stopped breathing. Those dark eyes, already large, widened when she saw him. He wanted to look past her carelessly, as if he had not seen her, but he could not tear his gaze away. He wanted her to smile at him, even if it was only the merest curving of her full lips. No more than a polite acknowledgment. He inclined his head to her, only slightly. It was more of a nod than a bow. Her face set in stiff lines, and she turned away to face the front. William winced as if he was in pain. He felt like a dog that had been kicked out of the way, and he wanted to curl up in a corner where no one would notice him. He glanced to either side, wondering whether anyone had seen the exchange of looks. As he walked farther up the aisle with his parents, he realized that people were looking from him to Aliena and back again, nudging one another and whispering.
He stared straight ahead to avoid meeting anybody's eyes. He had to force himself to hold his head high. "How has she done this to us?" he thought. "We're one of the proudest families in southern England, and she's made us feel small." The thought infuriated him, and he longed to draw his sword and attack someone, anyone. The sheriff of Shiring greeted William's father, and they shook hands. People looked away, searching for something new to murmur about. William was still seething. Young noblemen approached Aliena and bowed to her in a constant stream. She was willing to smile at them. The service began. William wondered how everything had gone so badly wrong. Earl Bartholomew had a son to inherit his title and his fortune, so the only use he had for a daughter was to form an alliance. Aliena was 16 years old and a virgin and showed no inclination to become a nun, so it was assumed she would be delighted to marry a healthy 19-year-old nobleman. After all, political considerations might just as easily have led her father to marry her to a fat, gouty 40-year-old earl, or even a balding baron of 60. Once the deal had been agreed, William and his parents had not been reticent about it. They had proudly broadcast the news all over the surrounding counties. The meeting between William and Aliena had been considered a formality by everyone, except Aliena, as it turned out. They were not strangers, of course. He remembered her as a little girl. She had had an impish face with a snub nose then, and her unruly hair had been kept short. She had been bossy, headstrong, pugnacious, and daring. She always organized the children's games, deciding what they should play and who should be on which team, adjudicating disputes and keeping score. He had been fascinated by her while at the same time resenting the way she dominated the children's play. It had always been possible to spoil her games and make himself the center of attention for a while, simply by starting a fight. But that did not last long, and in the end she would resume control, leaving him feeling baffled, defeated, spurned, angry, and yet enchanted, just as he felt now. After her mother died, she had travelled with her father a lot, and William had seen less of her. However, he met her often enough to know that she was growing into a ravishingly beautiful young woman, and he had been delighted when he was told she was to be his bride. He assumed she had to marry him whether she liked him or not, but he went along to meet her, intending to do all he could to smooth the path to the altar. She might be a virgin, but he was not. Some of the girls he had charmed were almost as pretty as Aliena, almost, although none of them was as high-born. In his experience, a lot of girls were impressed by his fine clothes, his spirited horses, and the casual way he had of spending money on sweet wine and ribbons. And if he could get them alone in a barn, they generally submitted to him, more or less willingly, in the end. His usual approach to girls was a little off-hand. At first he would let them think he was not particularly interested in them. But when he found himself alone with Aliena, his diffidence deserted him. She was wearing a bright blue silk gown, loose and flowing. But all he could think about was the body underneath it, which he would soon be able to see naked whenever he liked. He had found her reading a book, which was a peculiar occupation for a woman who was not a nun. He had asked her what it was, in an attempt to take his mind off the way her breasts moved under the blue silk. "It's called The Romance of Alexander. It's the story of a king called Alexander the Great, and how he conquered wonderful lands in the east, where precious stones grow on grapevines and plants can talk." William could not imagine why a person would want to waste time on such foolishness, but he had not said so. He had told her about his horses, his dogs, and his achievements in hunting, wrestling, and jousting. She had not been as impressed as he had hoped. He had told her about the house his father was building for them, and, to help her prepare for the time when she would be running his household, he gave her an outline of the way he wanted things done. He had felt he was losing her attention, though he could not say why. He sat as close to her as possible, for he wanted to get her in a clinch, and feel her up, and find out whether those tits were as big as he fancied they were. But she leaned away from him, folding her arms and crossing her legs, looking so forbidding that he was reluctantly forced to abandon the idea, and console himself with the thought that soon he would be able to do anything he liked to her. However, while he was with her she gave no indication of the fuss she was going to make later. She had said, rather quietly, "I don't think we're well suited." But he had taken this for a piece of charming modesty on her part, and had assured her that she would suit him very well. He had no idea that as soon as he was off the premises, she would storm into her father and announce that she would not marry him. Nothing would persuade her. She would rather go into a convent, and they could drag her to the altar in chains, but she would not speak the vows. The bitch, William thought. The bitch. But he could not summon the kind of venom that Mother spat when she spoke of Aliena. He did not want to flay Aliena alive. He wanted to lie on top of her hot body and kiss her mouth. The Epiphany service ended with the announcement of the death of the bishop. William hoped this news would at last overshadow the sensation of the cancelled marriage. The monks left in procession, and there was a buzz of excited conversation as the congregation headed for the exits. Many of them had material as well as spiritual ties to the bishop, as his tenants or subtenants, or as employees on his lands, and everyone was interested in the question of who would succeed him, and whether the successor would make any changes. The death of a great lord was always perilous for those ruled by him. As William followed his parents down the nave, he was surprised to see Archdeacon Walleran coming toward them. He moved briskly through the congregation, like a big black dog in a field of cows. And, like cows, the people looked nervously over their shoulders at him, and moved a step or two out of his way. He ignored the peasants, but spoke a few words to each of the gentry. When he reached the Hamleys, he greeted William's father, ignored William, and turned his attention on Mother. "Such a shame about the marriage," he said. William flushed. Did the fool think he was being polite with his commiserations? Mother was no more keen to talk about it than William was. "I'm not one to bear a grudge," she lied. Walleran ignored that. "I've heard something about Earl Bartholomew that may interest you," he said. His voice went quieter, so that he could not be overheard, and William had to strain to catch his words. "It seems the Earl will not renege on his vows to the dead king." Father said, "Bartholomew always was a stiff-necked hypocrite." Walleran looked pained. He wanted them to listen, not comment. "Bartholomew and Earl Robert of Gloucester will not accept King Stephen, who is the choice of the church and the barons, as you know." William wondered why an archdeacon was telling a lord about this routine baronial squabble. Father was thinking the same thought, for he said, "But there's nothing the earls can do about it." Mother shared Walleran's impatience with Father's interjected comments. "Listen!" she hissed at him. Walleran said, "What I hear is that they're planning to mount a rebellion and make Maud queen." William could not believe his ears. Had the archdeacon really made that foolhardy statement in his quiet, matter-of-fact murmur, right here in the nave of Kingsbridge Cathedral? A man could be hanged for it, true or false. Father was startled too, but Mother said thoughtfully, "Robert of Gloucester is the half-brother of Maud. It makes sense." William wondered how she could be so down-to-earth about such a scandalous piece of news. But she was very clever, and she was almost always right about everything. Walleran said, "Anyone who could get rid of Earl Bartholomew and stop the rebellion before it gets started would earn the eternal gratitude of King Stephen and the Holy Mother Church." "Indeed," said Father in a dazed tone, but Mother was nodding wisely. "Bartholomew is expected back at home tomorrow." Walleran looked up as he said this, and caught someone's eye. He looked back at Mother and said,
I thought you, of all people, would be interested. Then he moved away and greeted someone else.
William stared after him. Was that really all he was going to say? William's parents moved on, and he followed them through the great arched doorway into the open air. All three of them were silent. William had heard a good deal of talk over the past 5 weeks about who would be king, but the matter had seemed to be settled when Stephen was crowned at Westminster Abbey 3 days before Christmas. Now, if Walleran was right, the matter was an open question once again. But why had Walleran made a point of telling the Hamleys? They started across the green to the stables. As soon as they got clear of the crowd outside the church porch, and could no longer be overheard, Father said excitedly, "What a piece of good fortune! The very man who insulted the family caught out in high treason!" William did not see why that was such good fortune, but Mother obviously did, for she nodded agreement. Father went on, "We can arrest him at the point of a sword and hang him from the nearest tree." William had not thought of that, but now he saw it in a flash. If Bartholomew was a traitor, it was all right to kill him.
"We can take our revenge," William burst out, "and instead of being punished for it, we'll get a reward from the king."
They would be able to hold their heads high again, and—
"You stupid fools,"
Mother said with sudden viciousness.
"You blind, brainless idiots. So you would hang Bartholomew from the nearest tree. Shall I tell you what would happen then?"
Neither of them said anything. It was wiser not to respond to her questions when she was in this frame of mind. She said Robert of Gloucester would deny there had been any plot, and he would embrace King Stephen and swear loyalty, and there would be the end of it, except that you two would be hanged as murderers.
William shuddered. The idea of being hanged terrified him. He had nightmares about it. However, he could see that Mother was right. The king might believe or pretend to believe that no one could have the temerity to rebel against him, and he would think nothing of sacrificing a couple of lives for credibility. Father said, "You're right. We'll truss him up like a pig for the slaughter and carry him alive to the king at Winchester and denounce him there and claim our reward."
"Why don't you think?"
said Mother contemptuously. She was very tense, and William could see that she was as excited about all this as Father was, but in a different way.
"Wouldn't Archdeacon Walleran like to take a traitor trust to the king?" she said. "Doesn't he want a reward for himself? Don't you know that he lusts with all his heart to be Bishop of Kingsbridge? Why has he given you the privilege of making the arrest? Why did he contrive to meet us in church, as if by accident, instead of coming to see us at Hamley? Why was our conversation so short and indirect?"
She paused rhetorically, as if for an answer, but both William and Father knew that she did not really want one. William recalled that priests were not supposed to see bloodshed, and considered the possibility that perhaps that might be why Walleran did not want to be involved in arresting Bartholomew. But on further reflection, he realized that Walleran had no such scruples.
"I'll tell you why,"
Mother went on, "because he's not sure that Bartholomew is a traitor. His information is unreliable. I can't guess where he got it. Perhaps he overheard a drunken conversation, or intercepted an ambiguous message, or spoke with an untrustworthy spy. In any case, he's not willing to stick his neck out. He won't accuse Earl Bartholomew of treason openly in case the charge should turn out to be false, and Walleran himself be branded a slanderer. He wants someone else to take the risk and do the dirty work for him. And then, when it is over, if treason should be proved, he will step forward and take his share of the credit. But if Bartholomew should turn out to be innocent, Walleran will simply never admit that he said what he said to us today."
It seemed obvious when she put it like that. But without her, William and his father would have fallen right into Walleran's trap. They would have willingly acted as Walleran's agents and taken the risks for him. Mother's political judgment was acute. Father said, "Do you mean we must just forget about this?"
Certainly not.
Her eyes glittered. It's still a chance to destroy the people who have humiliated us. A groom held her horse ready. She took the reins and waved him away, but she did not mount immediately. She stood beside the horse, patting its neck reflectively, and spoke in a low voice.
We need evidence of the conspiracy so that no one will be able to deny it after we've made our accusation. We'll have to get that evidence by stealth, without revealing what we're looking for. Then, when we have it, we can arrest Earl Bartholomew and take him to the king. Confronted with proof, Bartholomew will confess and beg for mercy. Then we ask for our reward.
And deny that Walleran helped us, added Father. Mother shook her head.
Let him have his share of the glory and his reward. Then he will be indebted to us. That can't do us anything but good.
But how shall we go about finding evidence of the plot? Said Father anxiously.
We'll have to find a way to look around Bartholomew's castle, Mother said with a frown. It won't be easy. Nobody would credit us making a social call. Everyone knows we hate Bartholomew.
William was struck by a thought.
I could go, he said.
His parents were both a little startled. Mother said,
You'd arouse less suspicion than your father, I suppose. But what pretext would you have?
William had thought of that. I could go to see Eliana, he said, and his pulse raced at the idea. I could beg her to reconsider her decision. After all, she doesn't really know me. She misjudged me when we met. I could make her a good husband. Perhaps she just needs to be wooed a little harder. He gave what he hoped was a cynical smile, so that they would not know that he meant every word.
A perfectly credible excuse, said Mother.
She looked hard at William.
By Christ, I wonder whether the boy might have some of his mother's brains, after all.
William felt optimistic for the first time in months when he set out for Earl's Castle on the day after Epiphany. It was a clear, cold morning. The north wind stung his ears, and the frosted grass crunched under the hooves of his warhorse. He wore a grey cloak of fine Flanders cloth, trimmed with rabbit fur over a scarlet tunic. He was accompanied by Walter, his groom. When William was 12 years old, Walter had become his tutor in arms, and had taught him to ride, hunt, fence, and wrestle. Now Walter was his groom, companion, and bodyguard. He was as tall as William, but broader, a formidable barrel of a man. 9 or 10 years older than William, he was young enough to go drinking and chasing girls, but old enough to keep the boy out of trouble when necessary. He was William's closest friend. William was strangely excited by the prospect of seeing Aliena again, even though he knew he faced rejection and humiliation once more. That glimpse of her in Kingsbridge Cathedral, when for an instant he had looked into her dark, dark eyes, had rekindled his desire for her. He looked forward eagerly to talking to her, getting close to her, seeing her mass of curls tumble and shake as she talked, watching her body move under her dress. At the same time, the opportunity for revenge had sharpened William's hatred. He was tense with excitement at the thought that now he might wipe out the humiliation he and his family had suffered. He wished he had a clearer idea of what he was looking for. He was fairly confident he would find out whether Walleran's story was true, for there would surely be signs of preparation for war at the castle, horses being mustered, weapons being cleaned, food being stockpiled, even though the activity would naturally be masked as something else, preparations for an expedition, perhaps, to deceive the casual observer. However, convincing himself of the existence of a plot was not the same as finding proof. William could not think of anything that would count as proof. He planned to keep his eyes open and hope that something would suggest itself. This was not much of a plan, however, and he suffered a nagging worry that the opportunity for revenge might yet slip through his fingers. As he came nearer, he began to feel tense. He wondered whether he might be refused admittance to the castle,
and he suffered a moment of panic, until he realized how unlikely it was. The castle was a public place, and for the Earl to close it to the local gentry would be as good as an announcement that treachery was afoot. Earl Bartholomew lived a few miles from the town of Shiring. The castle of Shiring itself was occupied by the sheriff of the county, so the Earl had a castle of his own outside the town. The small village that had grown up around the castle walls was known as Earl's Castle. William had been there before, but now he looked at it through the eyes of an attacker. There was a wide, deep moat in the shape of the number 8, with the upper circle smaller than the lower. The earth that had been dug out to form the moat was piled up inside the twin circles, forming ramparts. At the foot of the 8 was a bridge across the moat and a gap in the earth wall, giving admittance to the lower circle. This was the only entrance. There was no way into the upper circle except by going through the lower circle and crossing another bridge over the moat that divided the two circles. The upper circle was the inner sanctum. As William and Walter trotted across the open fields that surrounded the castle, they could see a lot of coming and going. Two men-at-arms crossed the bridge on fast horses and rode off in different directions, and a group of 4 horsemen preceded William across the bridge as he and Walter entered. William noted that the last section of the bridge could be drawn up into the massive stone gatehouse that formed the entrance to the castle. There were stone towers at intervals all around the earth wall, so that every part of the perimeter could be covered by defending archers. To take this castle by frontal assault would be a long and bloody business, and the Hamleys could not muster enough men to be sure of success, William concluded gloomily. Today, of course, the castle was open for business. William gave his name to the sentry in the gatehouse and was admitted without further ado. Within the lower circle, shielded from the outside world by the earth walls, was the usual range of domestic buildings, stables, kitchens, workshops, a privy tower and a chapel. A sense of excitement was in the air. The grooms, squires, servants and maids all walked briskly and talked loudly, calling greetings to one another and making jokes. To an unsuspecting mind, the excitement and the coming and going might be no more than a normal reaction to the return of the master, but to William it seemed more than that. He left Walter at the stable with the horses and crossed to the far side of the compound, where, exactly opposite the gatehouse, there was a bridge across the moat to the upper circle. When he had crossed the bridge, he was challenged by another guard in another gatehouse. This time he was asked his business, and he said, "I've come to see the Lady Aliena." The guard did not know him, but he looked him up and down, noting his fine cloak and red tunic, and took him at face value as a hopeful suitor. "You may find the young lady in the great hall," he said with a smirk. In the center of the upper circle was a square stone building, 3 stories high with thick walls. This was the keep. As usual, the ground floor was a store. The great hall was above the store, reached by a wooden exterior staircase which could be drawn up into the building. On the top floor would be the Earl's bedroom, and that was where he would make his last stand when the Hamleys came to get him. The whole layout presented a formidable series of obstacles to the attacker. That was the point, of course, but now that William was trying to work out how to get past the obstacles, he saw the function of the different elements of the design very clearly. Even if the attackers gained the lower circle, they still had to pass another bridge and another gatehouse, and then assault the sturdy keep. They would have to get to the upper floor somehow, presumably by building their own staircase, and even then there would be yet another fight, in all probability, to get from the hall up the stairs to the Earl's bedroom. The only way to take this castle was by stealth, William realized, and he began to toy with ideas of sneaking in somehow. He mounted the stairs and entered the hall. It was full of people, but the Earl was not among them. In the far left-hand corner was the staircase leading to his bedroom, and 15 or 20 knights and men-at-arms sat around the foot of the stairs, talking together in low tones. This was unusual. Knights and men-at-arms formed separate social classes. The knights were landowners who supported themselves by rents, whereas the men-at-arms were paid by the day. The two groups became comradely only when the smell of war was in the wind. William recognized some of them,